Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Legacy Funding Finance Committee to order. First item, we do have a quorum, and so we'll do the approval of minutes from February 16th. Representative Wills, would you so move? Make sure you've read them over. That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hadn't looked at them yet when you called on me, so...
I've read the minutes, Mr. Chair. I'll move them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Green.
Thank you.
They're particularly good minutes. Thank you. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Before we get into our agenda today, I do have a question to ask. Mr. Hagemeyer, did you anything this weekend out of the ordinary happen to you?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would you care to inform the committee?
That's all right. No, I got married on Friday, so if anyone was looking for me on Friday, I was not here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
So, with that,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would just like to say you probably made a mistake getting married in February. I know I got married in February, and I get dinged twice, Valentine's Day and anniversaries. Keep that in mind.
Thank you. And if you have as big a heart as Representative Green does, that will be no problem for you. Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Green, is being dinged a good thing or not?
All right. Now, moving into the agenda. First item we have is the overview and funding request by the Minnesota Zoo. And as Mr. Emke is taking his place here at the witness table, we had those of us who could make it this morning had a very enjoyable experience out at the zoo. And thank you again for accommodating us this morning. Mr. Emke, would you identify yourself, please?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the president and director of the Minnesota Zoo, and would like to thank the members of the committee who were able to make it out this morning to get a small sampling of some of the programs that we offer. And I know Monday morning when it's minus 10, not the easiest time to come to the zoo, but I appreciate those of you who were able to come. Just wanted to give an overview of the programmatic overview of the entire zoo, of which the legacy funding is part. We've recently kind of re-expressed our mission, and this is our current mission statement, which is to connect people, animals, and the natural world to save wildlife, with an emphasis on the saving wildlife part. That is the thing that uniquely separates our zoo from other institutions, and it underlies all of the programs, including many that have been made possible through the Legacy Amendment. We are a public-private partnership. We work with the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, which is our 501c3 support group, which raises funds from the private sector. And as I'll point out, some of the funding that's come through the Legacy Amendment has actually spurred significant private investment in the zoo as well. For those of you not familiar with the zoo, we are a world-class institution with about 4,700 animals in our care. We have a 485-acre campus, which makes us one of the largest zoos in the country in terms of land area. We attract 1.2 plus million visitors on an annual basis to the zoo, which again puts us in about the top 20 of American zoos. Many of those are folks who are able to come for free through a pass program that we've been doing since we opened in 1978. We have over 1,000 adult volunteers who contribute significant hours and expertise to the zoo. Our education programs make us the largest environmental education center in the state, serving almost 500,000 people a year. And many of those are school groups. Nearly 100,000 participated in field trips and educational activities at the zoo. And many of those as well have been able to come free of charge through programs through the Minnesota Zoo Foundation that underwrite the cost of transportation, the classes, and even lunch at the zoo. Those of you who came in on the right-hand side of the door saw some of our Zoomobile animals. Our Zoomobile program is our premier outreach program that brings animals, educators in a van to schools and daycare centers and nursing homes throughout the state of Minnesota. Last year, 55 counties in Minnesota were served by Zoomobile. We are a conservation leader. I mentioned our mission statement and the idea of saving wildlife, not just within the zoo, but in nature. And we have been recognized nationally and internationally for the conservation work that we do with a variety of species, but with an increasing focus on Minnesota-based conservation problems and challenges, which, again, the legacy funding has allowed us to really expand in recent years. We are an economic engine for the state of Minnesota. As a state agency, we obviously seek state support, but the return on that investment is significant. When it was most recently studied, it was calculated that we generate $146 million worth of direct and indirect benefit for the state of Minnesota just through the operation of the zoo. That supports, again, 1,700 jobs, not just within the zoo, but the various businesses that support us and are connected with our operation. And we like to say that if you look at the return on the investment, for every dollar that the state invests in the zoo's operation, a return of $26 comes to the state of Minnesota, a pretty nice ROI. The programs at the zoo are many, but we kind of fit them into three general categories. Obviously, we're a recreational destination, a place for families to come with to have fun and enjoy themselves. But connected to that and really linked with that directly are the education programs and the conservation programs of the zoo. The legacy funding in the last, since it was established back in 2008, has been a very significant boon to the zoo in terms of allowing us to do new programming and expand programming that we in many cases always wanted to do but didn't have the resources to do previously. Here's the history of the legacy funding for the zoo. In the first biennium, we received $250,000 over the 2 years, which allowed us to pilot a number of programs that we've been able to continue and to expand. In 2011, the appropriation was $3 million, and then most recently, $3.5 million in the last biennium. There is a report in your package that outlines all of the programs that have been supported through this funding, with many of the results there for you to see as well. Our request for the current biennium, again, not knowing what the targets will be, but we are hoping to continue many of the programs that have been successful for us in the last biennium, and then a number of new initiatives that we'd like to fund. So our request for the upcoming biennium would be for $4.5 million between the 2 years. Legacy funding has become increasingly important for the overall operation of the zoo. Although we can't use legacy funds for the general, the general operation of the zoo, it has allowed us to expand our programming, and as such, it now constitutes about 7% of our total budget, which is obviously a very significant piece. And as I mentioned before, the investment of legacy funds has returned in many fold with private investment in programs that were piloted or studied initially using legacy funds. And I believe we did a calculation today. There was a question this morning. About $3.5 million worth of private funding has come to the zoo as a direct result of legacy funding and legacy programs that were initiated either in the last biennium or previously.
Mr. Chair, excuse me for interrupting, but Mr. Lemke, would you say that number again, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's $3.5 million of private funding that has resulted directly from programs that were initiated through the legacy funds in the last two biennia.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Lemke, and go back to that.
Representative Murphy,
yes.
Would you speak in the microphone, please?
Thank you.
Ms. Ramke. Representative Murphy, repeat the question, please.
Well, I'm looking at the slide with how much money came in, and that has then generated $3.5 million in additional funding from donors.
Mr. Ramke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct. An example of that would be in 2011, we had money to design and plan a new black bear exhibit for the Minnesota Trail. With those plans, we were able to secure $1 million gift to actually build the exhibit. And then when that was completed, additional legacy funds were used to create the interpretive program, so the graphics and the interactive exhibits that kind of finished off that exhibit. So that was a great example of a public-private partnership.
Representative Murphy.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lemke, then the additional funding that the legacy appropriation that added to that was also used for the same projects that the legacy projects were.
Mr. Lemke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's essentially correct. In the case that I just talked about, the Black Bear exhibit, you have a design phase, you have a construction phase, and then kind of a finishing phase for the interpretive program. And in that case, it was a combination of legacy funding and private money that allowed us to have that new exhibit.
Okay. Continue, please.
The way we look at the funding that we've received over the last three biennia is essentially in four buckets or baskets, types of programs. Some of it is the direct conservation work that we were able to do within the state of Minnesota. Probably the largest single bucket is the conservation education programming, both at the zoo and through our outreach programs. We also have a component that supports kind of the identification and the celebration of Minnesota's farming heritage through Wells Fargo Family Farm at the zoo. And finally, we do have habitat on the zoo site itself that we've been able to both study and improve using funds derived from the Legacy Amendment. Those four buckets are represented here by our proposal for how we would like to both continue many of those programs and expand them. Again, you can see that the bulk of the funding would go towards the Minnesota Natural Heritage conservation work and the conservation education work, again, that happens within the zoo and as part of our outreach program. We'd like to continue the funding for the farm, and then there's the evaluation of the programs and the administration, which would constitute the remainder of our request.
Is that legacy money that you would be using for those? Is that what that is?
That's correct. This is our proposal for
right.
the coming biennium.
Just making sure that it was clear.
Yeah. Thank you. On the natural heritage, Minnesota's natural heritage bucket, we are both celebrating and adding to the actual heritage through specific conservation programs. We've been involved in the research on the moose that's in combination with the University of Minnesota to try to understand what's happening to the population in northern Minnesota, and then to make recommendations for what might be done to slow the decline or stop the decline. We are working on bison reintroduction, working with the DNR on breeding bison at our zoo and reintroducing them to their former range in state parks. We're very excited this fall. Minneopa State Park will be the recipient of a small herd of bison, some of which were born at the zoo. These are purebred bison, which distinguishes them from most of the bison that are out there that have been interbred with cattle. So this is a significant kind of restoration of some of the natural heritage, the natural history of Minnesota in the remnants of the prairie ecosystem in southern Minnesota. And our education programs have increasingly been focused on Minnesota species and Minnesota environmental issues as a way to really focus on, as the state zoo, we think it's really important that we've been able to add those programs. A new project that we are hoping to fund in the upcoming biennium would focus on some of the aquatic ecosystems and aquatic species in Minnesota, particularly and specifically on mussels. Not zebra mussels, but on native mussels that have become endangered through habitat changes and the like.
Can you find a way to endanger the zebra mussels?
Mr. Chair, we actually hope that's the case. And this right now, we know that zebra mussels, in fact, smother and kill off colonies of the native mussels. The native mussels actually serve a pretty important ecological purpose. They help clean the water. And they actually provide a food source for fish. So we believe reestablishing mussel populations of the species that are supposed to be here will actually enhance the quality of the water quality and even the fishing quality of the state of Minnesota. We're also looking at some of the endangered turtles and frog species that we believe we can play a role in both understanding what's happening, why they're declining, and maybe get into some of the captive breeding programs as we've done with endangered butterfly species using the special expertise that we have at the zoo. Again, this would be very much a partnership with other agencies and other organizations interested in it, but it's something we believe really strongly emphasizes the conservation mission of the zoo and takes that expertise that zoos have and connects it with wildlife management programs here in the state, hopefully to bring some of these species back. Conservation education, again, we want to continue many of the successful programs that we're currently operating and funding with legacy funding. You've seen the Zoomobile program in action. Again, it takes animals and educators throughout the state. We had a couple examples of them out in the hallway greeting you as you came in. We've been able to expand that program that was one of the pre-existing education programs at the zoo through legacy funding, and we would like to continue that. We have a program called Close Encounters, which brings animals out into the public spaces of the zoo for one-on-one interactions. Again, those of you who were there this morning saw that, I think, in a very fun way with some of the species, the African species that we were able to bring out. That's a program we'd like to continue. Our World of Birds bird show, Free Flight Bird Show, again, is partially supported through legacy funding. We would like to continue that as well. And then as we look to do new exhibits and new interpretation of existing exhibits at the zoo, we've been able to, in the past, to use legacy funding. That's another area we would like to continue and to expand in the upcoming biennium. Again, a new program that we're looking at, which again is something we've piloted in recent years, but the idea of using technology to really extend the scope of the zoo's outreach programs is something we're just starting to scratch the surface of. Again, those of you who were able to visit the zoo this morning saw a little piece of that in action, our distance learning program that basically beams the zoo out to schools around the state is something we've started. It's been very successful, but we'd like to really, again, get on that technology bandwagon and expand it in a way that really will reach a far greater audience and more effectively use technology. I mean,
how long have you been doing that?
Mr. Chair, we started the pilot program, I believe, in the second biennium of the legacy, so 2010 or 2011. So we've started it kind of slowly. It greatly expanded last year.
How many schools were you in last year, do you know?
I don't have, the figures in the report, but it's significant. I think we reached about 5,000 individuals through the program, so somewhere in that range. We always talk about the zoo, that the thing that separates us from other experiences is the fact that we have live animals and that you have that direct experience with live animals. And that more and more as kids are getting kind of seduced by technology, we see ourselves as an antidote to that to some extent. But on the other hand, we realize that technology is going to be a way to reach more and more people to augment that live animal experience. And so part of our proposal is to really, again, expand the use of technology both at the zoo with our education programs and for the outreach efforts that we've already begun. Farming. When the zoo opened the Wells Fargo Family Farm back in 2000, a lot of people said, well, why, this is Minnesota. Why do you need to build a farm in Minnesota? And the reality was, as we did surveys, we realized very few kids these days, especially in urban and suburban areas, are really familiar with the farm, where food comes from, kind of that basic piece of Minnesota heritage. So we built the farm. It's been one of our most successful exhibits since it opened in 2000. But again, using legacy funds, we were able to expand the season in which the farm was open and the programming around the farm. So it's been a significant increase in number of visitors who are using the farm and getting a sense of that heritage, and then being able to do more programming, including farmers markets and other things that relate to food production as part of the overall farming heritage effort at the zoo. And finally, we do have some funds earmarked for evaluating all of these programs. That's actually one of the requirements, obviously, for this funding. And I think if, as you read the report, you can see we've been able to demonstrate both in terms of numbers of people reached and in many cases the educational outcomes of the programs. We're seeing great success with the programs developed to date. And then there are the overhead costs, which are modest, but there's something that we believe needs to be included as well as we develop our program. So it's we think a financially prudent approach that allows us to continue these programs without impacting the existing core operations of the zoo. And with that, happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Emke. Representative Murphy, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, on the evaluation and administration, can you tell us how much evaluation money and how much administration money?
Mr.
Chair, I would look to my and representative. I'm afraid I don't have those numbers offhand, but we'll have to be happy to.
I'd be interested in them.
Sure.
Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Emke, obviously some of these specific programs must specifically act to increase attendance at the zoo. In other words, people must specifically come from that. Is there any way you can keep track of that?
Mr. Emke?
Financial discussions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, certainly we do track when there are some of the programs like our speaker series are after hours, and so we very much can track, new visitors who are coming to experience that. Some of the other programs are part of the general zoo experience, and so they're interrelated with all the other things that affect our attendance, like weather, like other exhibits, like other attractions going on, so it's a little harder to piece those out. But again, as you go through the report, you can see there are specific numbers that indicate, in many cases, growth in the number of participants in the programs year over year. That certainly adds to our the overall impact of the zoo and our bottom line.
Thank you. Representative Murphy E.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had an email from a constituent about a trail that she has got some concern about and it being a part of the zoo's proposed budget for this committee. And I'm just wondering if there are trails in your proposal, and if so, if you could just share a little bit of information about that with me, please.
Mr. Remke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I believe your constituent was probably talking about the Greenway Trail that is a Dakota County project that is proposed to include a segment that would actually run through the zoo property. It's a bike and hiking trail that would, instead of skirting around the zoo, would come through the zoo. It is not part of this proposal, and in fact, the zoo is in support of the project, but is not financially committing any resources to it. This is a Dakota County project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Emke. Of the 485 acres that is currently the zoo property, how much of that are you utilizing for the existing animal exhibits?
Mr. Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, approximately half is used for either for exhibit purposes or for support operations at the zoo. The other half is currently undeveloped. It includes some very good habitat and a lot of wildlife that utilizes that land. So one of the opportunities that we see is using that as an educational resource to get visitors out into that undeveloped area and also to do habitat management in areas where we're seeing buckthorn invasion and the like. I think we've done a master plan for the zoo that envisions some expansion into that area, but for the most part, we want to leave a lot of it as natural habitat and, in fact, enhance that habitat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson?
Director Emke, are you actively managing the rest of that property for native wildlife?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson? Some of it we are, and part of our, we actually have an LCCMR proposal that would allow us to do more active management. Using some of the funding, I believe it was from the FY 11 legacy appropriation, we began some buckthorn management in selected areas of that habitat. So it's, I would say, a portion of the undeveloped area of the zoo is being managed now, and it's our intent in the future to expand that management for wildlife purposes.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. So this proposed trail, how much of the trail is on zoo property?
Mr. Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, it's a very extensive trail, so I don't know. It connects with existing bikeways that go into the Lebanon Hills Regional Park, which is our neighbor, and then connects up with other bikeways on the other on the south end of the zoo. So it really skirts the perimeter of the zoo. It's not taking up a lot. It's taking up no acreage that's currently developed at the zoo. It's it will allow us, we hope, to interpret some of that natural area that the trail will go through.
Thank you.
Mr. Hempkin, who is it parked through again? I mean, who is authorizing the park? Or, excuse me, the trail?
Mr. Chair, it's being authorized and funded by Dakota County.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Murphy?
And so will the bike riders be able to stop, ride their bikes then through the zoo, the exhibit areas and so forth?
Mr. Emke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, no. The area in question is actually inside the zoo boundaries, but outside of our USDA perimeter fence, which is all the exhibit areas are within that. So the bike ride will go through natural areas on the outskirts of the zoo that are part of zoo property, but not into the exhibit areas themselves. We hope that some of the riders will take the opportunity to stop and visit the zoo while they're there.
And pay a fee.
And pay a fee, correct.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy to the and others, I had the opportunity to ride my bike on a long trip across the country one time, and I can tell you that animals are a great motivator. You will
ride fast.
You can definitely motivate you to ride quite fast with 6 to 8 dogs chasing you at some point, and you can test your fitness. So it's, I would imagine a wild wolf would really, really get you going.
Mr. Emke, the trail doesn't go through the wolf area, does it? Or even the coyotes. The coyotes would.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Although we do have coyotes who have voluntarily gained admittance to the zoo property that are perhaps on a bike ride, you might have a chance to see them as well.
Representative Torkelson, when we have a nice summer day where we're going through the zoo, maybe spending a day of it, you will see that the snow monkeys' habitat is quite shabby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to seeing that.
We noticed that today.
Just a comment about this trail deal. You know, maybe you should, if you let people in free, but charge them to get out.
thank you. Any other questions? Any other comments?
No, other than to say we're very grateful for the support that the legislature has shown in the past with this program. It's been, as I mentioned at the beginning, an incredible augmentation of the programs at the zoo, and we do hope we can continue it and expand some of those programs with in the upcoming biennium. But thank you very much.
Well, thank you. The next presentation is the overview and funding request by the Perpich Center for the Arts. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourselves for the tape, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Mackert. I'm Executive Director of the Purpitt Center for Arts Education. And with me today is Dr. Pamela Paulson, Senior Director of Policy. I apologize for the size of my head. I think it's covering the screen. However, we shall continue. I'm going to give a few moments, if you will, to give an update as to why we are in front of this committee for those who may be new to the Purpitt Center and or to this committee, and then I'm going to ask Dr. Paulson to go through the specifics of our legacy project.
Thank you. Dr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Pam Paulson. I serve as Senior Director of Policy, and actually Sue will make some remarks and turn it back to me.
Just ping pong, or what are we doing here?
It is ping pong. You know, 30 years ago, the legislature made a bold decision to invest in arts education, to impact student achievement, feed the state's economic engine, and position Minnesota for global competition. This visionary leadership prompted the creation of the Purpitt Center for Arts Education. From its inception, Purpitt Center has offered consistent and essential leadership for rural, urban, and suburban school districts on research-based, innovative models for the delivery of education in and through the arts. This conscious investment in arts education has had demonstrated impact toward the status Minnesota enjoys today as a national leader in education. Our success in this arts education brought us to this committee in 2009, when a Senate subcommittee on arts education asked that we use our expertise to help fulfill the mission of arts education rooted in the language of Minnesota's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund Amendment, and you responded affirmatively. Thus began a groundbreaking initiative, a legacy, if you will, as a special team of education leaders developed a program to increase the capacity of teachers to design, implement, and assess collaborative arts integration in Minnesota schools. We're very proud of the role we play in fulfilling Minnesota's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund Amendment. As the state agency charged with the advancement of arts education in Minnesota schools, we've been very pragmatic in our approach in developing and implementing innovative programs with legacy dollars that are assessed for their effectiveness and long-term sustainability. Use of legacy funds does not supplant our agency's role in arts education. Rather, it enables us to capitalize on our expertise and on the work other state agencies and programs have been able to affect with legacy funding. Students across Minnesota have unmatched opportunities to experience, learn about, and appreciate the arts. We then come in and help teachers take that enjoyment and appreciation through our Purpitt Legacy Project to help teachers learn to embed that positive student experience into the curriculum and add value to the academic classroom through arts integration. Hence, teachers and students are engaged and learning improves. We consider this to be a very valuable outcome of Minnesota's citizens' commitment to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we are here today to seek continuation of those programs. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I may, ask Dr. Paulson to provide an overview of the Purpitt Center legacy projects.
Well, thank you. Dr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we're very, very happy to be here to share the exciting work that we've been able to do because of your support. And this map that's up on the screen should be in your packets. I don't know if you actually have the folders or not, but if you have a folder, it would be off to the left-hand side. And it gives you some information on the right-hand side with a handout that says Turn Around Arts Minnesota. So that's the first program that we'd like to talk with you about. The second page is about the Arts Integration Network, which is the one that's been going on for a couple of years now. And then behind that is a page with our request and a little chart that's got a timeline on it. And then finally, the budget. So what you see on this map are the sites that we've been able to work with in the Turnaround Arts Program, the Secondary Course Development, and the Turnaround Arts. And as Sue said, these are really about helping teachers and students improving their work and their skills through integrating the arts into their schools, and it affects the curriculum, it affects their achievement, it affects the environment, it affects even parent and community involvement. Teachers need focused and deep kinds of professional development in order to do their best job at helping students learn. And I found it really interesting that a recent report by the Center for Public Education said that their studies have shown it takes 50, possibly up to 80 hours of professional development for a teacher to successfully be able to learn about a new strategy and implement it. 50 to 80 hours of professional development. And that's what we do through this project. We are out in those schools at least three times during the year. Those teachers come to a regional meeting where our staff goes out and does professional development. We connect with them on Skype. We provide an ongoing way of professional development, which is really necessary. And as you know and have heard many times in the last few years, teachers really are the most important factor in promoting student achievement in the schools.
Would you repeat that, please?
Teachers are the most important factor in promoting student achievement, and it's true. I'm a teacher, too, and so I know the responsibility we have and the opportunity we have there. But one thing that struck me very sort of sad was I read a Gallup poll that was done in 2013, so it's been a couple of years, but that Gallup poll made me concerned because it indicated that many teachers are not really engaged in their jobs. In fact, the Gallup poll indicated it could be as high as 7 out of 10 teachers not engaged in their work. And as Sue pointed out, that is what this project does. It engages the teachers. Even veteran teachers who've been doing this work for a very long time come away extremely thankful for the opportunity to collaborate with their peers and to gain some new skills and insight. So the two programs that we're talking about today are the Turnaround Arts and the Arts Integration Network. And you will see that in this program so far, we've been able to impact about 11,500 plus students. And that doesn't just, it's not a general number. Those are actual kids who were in actual experiences with us. 434 teachers in 54 Minnesota schools. So the Turnaround Arts program is the first one. And this is a part of a national program from the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. That committee was started by Ronald Reagan when he was the president, and it's been continued by each successive president since then, who sometimes give things a little bit of their own flavor or their own spin. And Turnaround Arts is the program of the current committee, and we're finding it to be exceptionally interesting. Turnaround Arts is involves 4 schools for us right now, 175 teachers, and 1,700 students. And in your packet, you will see these 4 schools, Bethune in Minneapolis, Northport in Robbinsdale, Northside in St. James, and Red Lake Middle School. So those little dots on the map show you where they're located. The thing you need to know about these schools is they have to be in the lowest 5% of any schools in the state that they are from. So they have to be these most struggling schools to be part of this initiative. So we identified this problem that these
Dr. lowest... Dr. Paulson, what? St. James.
St. James.
Every meeting I go to, St. James has something.
Well, they were in the lowest 5% of the performers, so they did get some attention.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now I understand. Thank
yep.
you.
And so the problem in our estimation is that we've got an achievement gap and we've got an opportunity gap in these schools, and we feel like the arts can be a major, major thrust for improvement in those schools. So our solution is to leverage the arts to increase student learning, student engagement, family and community involvement, teacher capacity, and school climate. The President's Committee did a very, very nice publication called Reinvesting in Arts Education, Winning America's Future Through Creative Schools, and that contains a lot of research that supports the need and the benefit of arts for kids, including that kids in Arts programs tend to perform academically better than their peers. And in the high school level, they have higher graduation rates. All grades attendance goes up, greater self-confidence, and they're more likely to go on to higher education and actually stick it out and finish. This program is actually an elementary and middle school program. And the research also shows that kids that have arts, even though they're low-income kids, if they've got arts in their program, they tend to perform more like average higher-income students. That's a very powerful thing to think about, and it's especially true for students that might otherwise feel like they don't have a place and they are excluded, including our English language learners. So the measures that we've been using are test scores, classroom assessments, behavior referrals, attendance data, and family participation counts. We would love to continue this program with these four initial schools because we know it takes some time for them to make these kinds of significant changes for 1,088,000. And we'd love to be able to expand to add four additional schools that are in the bottom 5%. So that would be a process of selecting them the first year and then working with them the second year of the biennium for $686,000, totaling $1.775. So that was the first program. The second program is not whole school, but it is about teams of teachers in these schools that decide they want to work on how to integrate the arts. And we've got three regions, and I put a little plus on there because we actually have this little program that we've sort of spun off. It's not a whole region like you saw on the map, but it's something I want to mention to you. So the first region that we worked with was Lakes Country out in the west central part of the state, and we actually are still working with Lakes Country in that we are inviting all of the schools that have ever participated in these programs to come to an annual arts integration conference, so that it'll be teachers from all over the state. And we're also very happy that we have a pretty robust website where they can continue to get resources and can interact with others doing this. The second region that we worked with was the Southeast, and you can see all those red places. This region was on fire. They loved this work, and so each year they added people to their teams, and they wanted to add new teams. So this group has been phenomenal to work with. The region that we are currently in right now is the Northeast region. And the reason that this is such a critical time for you to understand this program is that we've considered it a three-year program. And the Northeast region is just in year one. So in order to finish their whole program, they would need to go through the next biennium in order to have the benefit of 3 years of assistance with their students. And then here's this little plus. It's not a region, but it's mostly in the metro area, which is not the focus of this arts integration project. But I wanted you to know that we keep thinking about how can we make this sustainable. And so we selected four schools to develop whole courses that can be year-long, can be semester-long, and they'll go in the course catalog of those schools so that kids can take these courses year after year. And also they can be models for urban, suburban, rural schools to make the best of it. But really, this program is a rural program, as you saw from all of those dots on the map. And the problem that we identified was that there are fewer resources for arts education, fewer resources for professional development, and there's an opportunity gap for the students. So, and all of these photographs that are up here are the real kids from the real program. This is Lake Park Audubon School. So our solution was to create these learning opportunities in networks of teachers across the state, where the teachers come together for many, many hours to study how to do a better job of instruction, assessment, curriculum design. And we have been able to keep an evaluator as a part of our external feedback on the program. And that external evaluation team has shown us that in the last, they've been on board for 2 years. In the last 2 years, the students are four times more likely to be judged highly engaged and highly thoughtful in their classrooms than their peers in non-arts integrated classrooms.
Dr. Paulson, yes. So how does this work? I mean, do you send instructors out to work with the teachers, or do the teachers come in to some central area from the region and meet, or how do you do this?
Mr. Chair, committee members, what a great question. We send our teachers out so that they go to these sites, to every one of those schools, at least three times during the year. And at least three times during the year, our teachers go out to the region and convene the regional groups together. There's none of that happens in the metro area. Everything is on site in the schools. The one thing that we decided, now that we're getting so many teachers from all across the state, is in the summer, we will do one conference where we invite everybody to come to the Purpich Center, and they'll get to have an opportunity to meet people from all over the state. So thank you for that.
Dr. Paulson, when you do that, it might be a good idea to let the committee know.
Ooh, love to do that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. A little chart here gives you the specifics about this engagement and thoughtfulness. And thoughtfulness means things like, are the students asking good questions? Are they analyzing and seeming like they're understanding the content? That's what we, our evaluators, decided to call thoughtfulness. So in 2012-13, about 50% of the students demonstrated high engagement and high thoughtfulness in the arts integrated lessons, compared to 20% of the classrooms that the evaluators observed. And the reason that we hired this evaluation group was they were willing to go into every classroom and make an actual on-the-ground observation, not just asking for people's opinion. And then last year, this went up to 67% of the students showed high engagement and high thoughtfulness in the arts integrated classrooms, as opposed to only 15% in the other classrooms, that's pretty interesting information. So in terms of teacher capacity, we found out that they certainly have more knowledge about arts integration. They love collaborating with each other, something that they rarely get to do. They're great now at creating some units and curriculum design around arts integration. The piece that we've been really working hard on and struggling a little bit with them is better and better assessment of student learning. And then the final thing is they're using their student work products to really analyze what they need to do differently in their classrooms. So we've been looking in the classrooms at their achievement of the students' standards, and we've been able to have our evaluators go in and do these observations on site. We've been doing the professional development on site and in person, but we also wanted you to know that we've created a website, and we've been trying to use technology for extra meetings in between the face-to-face by using technology to do that. And these units that the teachers are creating are being curated and put up on this website. We have 20 of them up right now, and I went and looked at them over the weekend because a couple new ones went up. And I said to the team, this is really elegant. It is a really, really elegant presentation of the standards that the students are working on, the lesson that was taught, the assessment that was done, the criteria that was used, and then it includes samples of student work. So I'm really proud of it. And I have to tell you, there is no other place in the country that I know of that has done this work and has this kind of resource available to teachers that is includes all of those facets. So the request for this program is to continue that Northeast region for two more years so they can finish their cycle at 1.635, and to expand into a new region, but to try to do it more electronically and add a regional site with an online focus for 267,000. We're not sure that's going to be totally effective because our evaluators have said they really appreciate the visits and the attention and the personalization that we give the program. But we think that it's a wave of the future, and we would like to try to do that. So the full request is 3.678, and I thought you would like to see a little video of some second graders. You are going to love this. It's a great example from one of our classrooms, McKinley Elementary in Owatonna. Sorry, I have to figure out why that happened. Simon, help me. Thank you.
Husengate. I work at McKinley Elementary in Owatonna, Minnesota. And we are working on an arts integration project here, trying to extend our students' learning, being able to sort and identify different stages of the life cycle of a plant.
We have been doing a project on plants, and we made claymation movies to go with it. We were showing how a plant goes from a seed to adult, and we have been working a lot on it.
This is our first year at McKinley Elementary as a STEM school. We wanted to make sure that something with STEM, science, technology, engineering, or math was a part of what we did with our project. We started to look at the science standards in second grade and how we could make artwork with what we were doing. The big idea we started with was change. What kinds of things change? What kind of things in the second grade curriculum can show change? The students first began in the classroom learning about the life cycle of plants. We used our STEM journal, and it's a composition journal that we use, and they would do some research on the computer, or we would do some reading, and they would keep their thoughts in their journal. They took that into the art room, where they drew technical pictures of those stages. After they did the technical drawings, they took a stage of a particular plant, whether it was a potato or a tomato and so on, and each child took clay and produced their stage, and from there they built their claymation video.
The tinier movements you have, the better your movie is going to look. That's a really great video, you probably would have 100 pictures.
A lot of them really got into it. They had their backgrounds going with the clouds floating across the page, the rain coming down. I think one group even had their plant dying and turning into a seed and growing again. Another group ended up having a little person walk onto the page and ate the fruit that the plant grew. After they had finished their claymation, they came back to the classroom where we created a timeline of the plant life cycle and a human life cycle and showed the correlation between the two so that they could make connections. Then they wrote their story or their narrative that would tell the story that would go with the claymation video. The kids are excited about the things that they've created and they want to share them with others. I would love to do this project again, and hopefully we can do it with all of our second graders next year. Early in the project, when Amanda and I were co-teaching, we worked very well because I taught the science piece where she would support it with the art piece, and it just seemed to flow because the two were built together. I really think the lesson was much stronger for our students.
Aren't they adorable? We feel so lucky to be able to work with these teachers and kids across the state of Minnesota. And we cannot thank you enough for the support you've given us to allow us to do that. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And I think it is important to bring in other disciplines into the subject areas. And when I taught American history, we taught the Civil War. I had in English, they were writing poems. In art, they were doing drawings. I taught my students the Virginia Reel each year. So they would learn the type of dances during the Civil War.
That's right, and the music.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kahn?
Are you going to demonstrate it?
No. Not going to do that. Oh, but that would be a thought. We maybe could do that. No, there's not enough room. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just had a question in regard to the appropriation and how it's been used in the past. Did legacy have an impact on the projects that were being done in the presentation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, absolutely. The legacy funds were the thing that made this happen, without a doubt. And again, we're so happy that we get to work in the rural part of Minnesota because we feel like there aren't as many resources for the students and the teachers, and they are so very appreciative of it. We've really appreciated the evaluator being able to be out in the field and collecting information for us because it helps shape our program. For example, the first year we just assumed that teachers would be able to jump into the idea of collaborating with each other, and we didn't provide much support for that idea, and then we found out that that is not something that they have an opportunity to do, and they really, really wanted more help with how to make that effective. So with that evaluation, we were able to step back in and redesign our program a little bit for the second year, and we've continued to do that. So each part of the funds allow us to do different things like that evaluation, like the work on the sites, we call that coaching, like bringing the teachers together for workshops, we call that professional development. So all those parts were important.
Representative Miller?
I just wanted to see a dance.
I did not participate. It was the seventh graders who were doing the Virginia Reel. I just told them how. Yes, well, it was a first for me. It was the first time many seventh grade boys had touched a seventh grade girl. It was my social interaction that I was promoting. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no desire whatsoever to see you dance. But I do have
that's
a question.
My wife said.
You talk about resources lacking in rural districts. Just what resources are you referring to?
Dr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, one of the things that is lacking and that we feel we can help with is a curriculum that has lots and lots of choices for kids, because often the schools are quite small and they don't have a lot of individual courses. And so in this project, we can take subject areas and combine them together and give students not only the experience in something that they might not have a full course in, but they certainly will get an experience that shows them how subjects are related to each other. We also find in this program that we're able to, and this is really interesting to me, we encourage them to use the community resources. We want them to bring in artists from their communities if there are artists that are interested and available. And it's funny because at first they don't think of that as an option. And then we give them all sorts of encouragement to use those cultural and artistic community resources. And it is one of the things that is life-changing for these teachers when they see that somebody else recognizes the value of their work and contributes to it and values these kids. So just connecting the resources that are out there to the school program is a big benefit of what this program allows to do. And it also gives the teachers a little bit of money in order to purchase some things because they don't have much money for buying supplies, artistic kinds of supplies. So this does give them a little bit of money to do that.
Ms. Becker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the other thing that we hear from our communities that comes through very much on their application forms is that they may lack the resources for professional development, specifically in arts integration. And so by being part of this network, they have access to something that they cannot generally get in their area of the state. And what is so heartbreaking at times in reading the application forms is they will state, generally the principal or the superintendent, is that we want all our students to have the same access as students in larger areas that may have more access to arts integration or education than we do here. And so it is their perception and their need for more advanced levels of professional development that is lacking within their communities.
Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like most of the resource you're speaking of is financial, actually, that the school districts can't afford to have the development time for their teachers, and that's a challenge.
Dr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, it certainly is a challenge, but the other piece about it is expertise. And that's the part that I think they so appreciate, is when our staff get to come to their schools and work with them and their students in their setting. It's that expertise of knowing arts integration and knowing how to facilitate the learning of the teachers. So it's money, but it's also expertise.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you. And so does that expertise you're speaking of exist in other, in metro schools that are... I'm trying to get the this rural-metro separation that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So are metro schools rich in this expertise?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Representative Paulson. Torkelson, the metro schools have greater access to the community resources, I think, because these arts organizations are more affluent for the most part, and they are providing opportunities for schools in a larger way than the smaller arts organizations in the rural schools are able to do. And it's a big operation in the Twin Cities to have the arts organizations participate in the schools. It's a very big operation. The Ordway, the Guthrie, the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, they all have education programs and education directors and education budgets. They provide busing, they provide workshops, and a lot of that is just over the top compared to what's available in the smaller areas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Murphy E.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in follow-up to that question, when I have been to the Ordway, which is in St. Paul for school events, there have certainly been children present from all over the state of Minnesota on those buses that you speak to. So, you know, I appreciate that we're having quite a dialogue in Minnesota right now about our geographic divisions. And I appreciate your description of the way you see the implementation of arts education happening across the state, but I'm not sure that it is accurate to say that some of those resources that you're describing in the metro area as not being available to kids across the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Any other questions? Comments? Wish to conclude?
Just thank you so very much on behalf of all these teachers and kids around the state.
Thank you very much.
Good chair.
Our next item today is the a bill requesting funding for the state band. Representative Kahn? I don't see any tubas or bugles or anything. Representative Kahn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is one of two bills dealing with the state band, and instead of doing a presentation about it, I'd like to present my testifier who has a commitment and has to leave early. So if Mr. Booty would come up. This is a bill for a small appropriation for the state band, and he will tell you what it's for. And to I will confess to members of this committee that the first appropriation for the state band was done when I was, I believe, a freshman member on the State Department's division, chaired by the very famous or infamous Representative Neil Hoggerud. And he was the one who did this, and I was outraged at it at the time. I thought it was not a serious thing for state government to be involved in, but you can
see
that
I've... Your thinking has evolved over the years.
Yes. But people who think I never changed my mind on anything, this is definite proof. So, Mr. Booth, just say who you are.
Identify yourself. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm Chuck Booty. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Band.
Would you spell your last name, please?
D-O-O-D as in David, Y. If you are old enough from Dawson, Minnesota, you remember my father, who's the doctor. A long time ago. We have two ways I could do this. I could read it or I could talk to you. I would prefer to talk to you. I was a debater once upon a time. I was also a square dance caller if you really want to do that for Junior Reel.
I think that'll be for our session and cotillion.
You know, in another life, I'm a musicologist, just to say I'm a music historian. I have a PhD from the university. And I'm at the very beginning of trying to figure out the history of the state band. And way too early to talk very much about that, but I think there are three things that I've discovered that are probably important to the committee. First of all, it's the only state band left. It was formed in 1898. I suspect that the formation goes back earlier and probably to the Civil War and the bands that came out of the Civil War, but I haven't got any proof of that yet. Second, there's ample records of funds being given to the state band from the state of Minnesota. $1,762 in 1914. Somebody else figure out what it's worth today. I don't
know. So when actually was the state band established? Do we have a date?
It was established in 1898, as far as we know. I suspect it goes back further. The first concert that I know of was at Como Park. Christian Selling said, composed a march called First at Como, which we're trying to find and haven't yet. So there's ample records of funds being allocated from time to time. And third, there are three separate requests for nonprofit status. Now, my understanding is this because nonprofit status expired and had to be resubmitted over the years. They all have one thing in common, and that is they talk about the goals of the band. And they mention expanding the opportunity of citizens of the state to hear band music and support the state and the government through performances and publicity. Funds have come from time to time from the state. I think I might have been on the other side of this also had these funds requests been coming from the regular funds, frankly. The legacy funds is placed for it. So we try to meet these goals in several ways. We have public concerts, 10 to 15 a year. We participate in events in support of music or people support
the state. Do people pay to attend the concerts?
No. The concerts are free. We sometimes plead with them for money, but they don't have to give us any. And in fact, we don't even have the person sitting at the door saying, "It's so nice to see you. See the donation sign?" We don't do that. So we participate in events and sports music people important to the state. Joint concerts with schools, and we'll talk more about that later. Appearances at Memorial Day, the Veterans Home, and things of that sort. And then thirdly, we program music related to Minnesota and to its historic events. Our next concert is all Minnesota music by Minnesota composers. And it includes a recognition of Steve Paulus, if any of you know him, who died recently. A major American composer and a major impact on contemporary music in general. In 2011, we did a whole series of concerts recognizing the anniversary of the start of the Civil War, which included bringing in singers to do things like Lorena and narrators for Copeland's The Lincoln Portrait. We want to expand these things. So the question is, why can't we? And the answer is to look at our budget a little. Our income last year was $10,938.
How much again?
$10,938. Our membership dues, we charge $50 for every person who wants to play with us.
How many do you have in your band?
We are at the moment at about 48. Always interested in more if they're good players and we can find them.
Do you have to audition? I mean,
yes. Actually,
you just couldn't walk off the street and be in the band.
You can walk off the street and we'll sit you in the band, and the people next to you will say to me, "I wonder about this person." And if they say that, I will audition them.
Let's say that you played the drums or something back in your youth, which wouldn't be me, but maybe somebody else on the committee. You could be possibly in the state band.
That's a possibility, yes. Yes. It's a very loose audition. Now, since you bragged that up, I have to also say that the level of performance of the players is pretty high. Every once in a while, somebody comes in, sits down, plays one rehearsal, and leaves because they know they can't do it. So it's a very self-selecting situation. So our income was $10,900 and some dollars. $50 a year to pay after you've been in the band for a year, brought in 18% of that. We have associate members who will pay money, as most nonprofits do, people who support them. That brought in 21%. We brought in 9% of the money from income that we were paid when a concert venue asked us to come and play. We have some other matching grants and small monies, and then we have an MRAC grant, a Minnesota Regional Arts Council grant, of $5,000. Okay, that's about $10,800. Now, last year we spent $12,561. 12% of it went to directors. The two of us, we got paid $1,500. The average pay for community bands around this area is between $3,500 and $12,000. Now, let me add that we're not looking for money for the directors. We'll struggle with that as time goes on. But I want you to understand the directors are a relatively small part of it. We spent $4,850 on a stage manager. We rehearse in the basement of the DOT building in the cafeteria. Everything has to be moved, made into a band setting, music instruments hauled from another room, storage, and then it has to be set back again. In addition, the stage manager sets up the stage for concerts and things of that sort. So that's why that's such a large amount of money. We spent about $1,400 on music. Currently, new works cost about $125 each. So it doesn't go very far. This last year, and this is the reason things jumped, we spent $2,875, excuse me, for postage, advertising, and things of that sort. We're trying to reach out within the budget. And we have about $1,500 in truck rental costs. You have to get your equipment to the concert somehow. As you can see, without that MRAC grant, we'd be in real trouble. We wouldn't be buying music. We wouldn't be paying conductors. And we would be dipping into the left money that's left, which is not very much. It's about 1 year's worth of money that sits behind things as the backlog. So, even if this grant is granted, we don't intend to do anything different with the yearly budget. We'll continue to ask for donations. We'll continue to try and get the MRAC grant. We'll continue to ask members to pay. We're after things that have other issues. The Regional Arts Grant does not support expenditures outside the metropolitan area, so we can't do outreach beyond the metropolitan area on those funds. There are no funds to repair or replace instruments. Many of them are 40 years old or more, and if you were packed up in a box and unloaded 15 times a year going out in a truck and 40 or 50 times a year coming into a rehearsal stage, you'd be worn out too. So there is no fund to do that, and there's little money for publicity or to carry out other initiatives. So you have in front of you a very rough budget somewhere, and I don't want to insult you by reading that budget, but I will tell you what we would like to do with that budget. In no particular order on these, but we would like to do them. Travel out state to cooperate with local bands and other groups and present. You need to know that music is a joy that continues through adult life. And performing with adults is a wonderful way to make this happen. In the past 2 years, we've performed with the Farnsworth Aerospace Magnet in St. Paul and the Minneapolis Roosevelt High School bands. And both cases, fundraising a little bit for their programs. But I think it's outside the metropolitan area where we can do the most good because they have the least access to this sort of thing. We have tours thought about in southeastern and northern Minnesota. We have some interest from band directors. Obviously, we cannot move forward without funds. I grew up in Dawson, Minnesota, if any of you remember where Dawson is. And I went to school.
It's right by Boyd.
Yeah, you got it. Right down the road there. In fact, my dad was the doctor for Boyd in those days. Later on, I was at White Bear Lake, which was 5,500 people when I moved there, and 55,000 when I moved away. I taught music in Edgerton, Ellsworth, Ruthven, and later in Belle Plaine, so I know what kind of things some exposure can do for those kids. So that's number one thing. Number two, repair or replace tired band-owned instruments and uniforms. Currently, members purchase their band shirts. For heaven's sakes, there are many bands who are able to give them away. I suspect, frankly, that we'll continue to try and have them purchased, but still. Third, find an intern. There are intern programs from the colleges that would get you an intern free. But that intern needs funds to improve our outreach and to increase memberships in the groups that support us. There are intern programs, as I said, through several colleges. Four, establish a website that lists compositions and arrangements for band by Minnesota composers. We'd link the performances of the works, and we'd link to the sales site if the work is published, and we would hope to make available in electronic ways some of the works that aren't published that have been composed around the state. Some of them are very, very good. Only three of the works in our concert are formally published. The others should be available. And last, commission quality works for band by Minnesota composers. Sigma Alpha Iota, the National Music Fraternity, is currently involved in commissioning major work for us. We'd like to contribute some money. It's kind of embarrassing if we can't. So despite that lack of funds, we have managed two commissions since 2009. So that's some of the dreams. And I submit that this is exactly the sort of funding that the legacy funds should support. And I notice that this does not require legislators to find funds in the budget to meet the request. The funds are already allocated. All that's necessary is to recognize the validity of our request. This might be, in fact, one of the few nonpartisan issues you get to talk about this year. I hope it is, at any rate. If I can go off direct topic and answer one question that's been asked by several people. How many people who are state employees are in the band? There are six current state employees, and there are 11 or 12, we're not sure which, retired state employees currently in the band, 18 of, say, 50. Truth to be told, though, the band is not like the Honeywell band and the 3M band, which were designed to be bands from those companies. It was always, has always been a band to support the state, but drawing from the general musical population. Okay, I've hit the end. What
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that I would direct my question at Representative Kahn. This is my first opportunity to sit on this committee, and I'm trying to understand how legacy dollars were intended to be used, and you probably have some institutional context for this. Is this an expansion of what otherwise would be normal everyday operations?
Representative Kahn.
The issue was, is it a supplanting or supplementing of something that was in the state budget? And there's been very little of the state band in the state budget. We did have this use of space, which there was no charge for, and then suddenly Representative Murphy was instrumental in writing the most outraged letter when the Commissioner of Administration tried to cut that off last year. So we did stop them from cutting that off, at least temporarily. But they do need some, and that's the other Representative Freiberg's bill, which gives them official state recognition. Apparently governor's proclamations and that kind of thing wasn't enough. But I think, I don't see any. The last appropriation to the state band was a $300 line item, which was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. I think the cost of doing the veto was probably more than the $300 that was going to be expended. But so there hasn't been any real support on the state level. So it is really a new project, but yeah, it fits into what my concept of what legacy should be, the existed. You know, bands, I think, are one of the prime legacy issues that a state should support.
Just add, Representative Kahn, that you know we are not supposed to supplant traditional sources of funding, and traditional sources of funding, the definition that I've been giving, means a consistent source of funding, and you know, this certainly has not been a consistent source of funding. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for the most part you just answered my question, but I would add to it ever so slightly. Representative Kahn, again, just with that institutional context again, are there other groups that would see this as a potential change to how we've appropriated dollars? Just want to confirm, just to understand a little bit more clearly, that's all.
Representative Kahn.
Let's have Mr. Booty answer that.
Mr. Booty.
I don't see any that would be similar to this in terms of, you know, the concept of the word legacy. And I suggest that we gave you the pamphlet that was done when Representative Murphy was the first chair of the Legacy Committee. And I think that's a really good thing to look at for the philosophy. It's stood through two other chairs since then, which shows a remarkable consistency for the legislative issue. So, okay. Mr. Booty, did you want to say
something?
No,
Mr. Booty, do you
I don't think I need to add to that.
All right. Representative Murphy.
Since we're part of history, I was kind of active with the Minnesota band, state band, during the Perfect Years, and when they had several trips overseas, I accompanied them on behalf of Governor Burbidge on the tour to Austria and Germany, which we visited, I don't know, maybe 11 cities and had two concerts a day kind of thing. And we went to the 500th anniversary of Ruppolding in Germany, and it was a two-hour parade in which 100 units or more marched, and the people from Germany were wearing their historical uniforms, which were fur, and it was over 100 degrees in the summer. And it was a fantastic historical tour in the sense that we visited so many historical entities and played before them. And I have several remembrances from there which were given to me to give to Governor Perpich, and he said, put them in your office. And so they still are in my office. At that time, the band was, there were a lot more state employees that were part of the band at that time.
President Murphy, were you part of the band?
No, I was the representative. I wore a red, white, and blue dress most of the time, and I smiled and was the greeter to meet with the mayors and the princesses and the band directors and the every city that we attended had a host band, and so they would play some and we would play some, and I would smile and greet, and there seemed to be a large consumption of beer too. And great food. Just great food. But it was really Hands Across the Ocean, and every place we went they said, it's music and sports that will bring the world together in peace. And in those days, there was no money. I believe that there at that time, there was a small stipend from the State Government Finance Committee for purchase of music. and I'm thinking that it was $3,000 a year. But there was all the fundraising for the trip had to be done by the band members, and we sold the world's best chocolate candy bars at the time. And I bet I sold thousands of dollars worth of world's best chocolate right here in the SOB building because they would come by and they would leave. I would have an open box on my desk and they would leave their dollars and they would take the chocolate. And that's the way much of that tour got paid for, was with the world's best chocolate and donations from the people that were the band members. And they were loyal, and they were true, and they were wonderful state employees and friends of the wonderful state employees. And after that tour, they went to Spain, and there was one more tour to Germany, and there were two visits of German bands to St. Paul as a result of that first tour. So that's my history lesson for the day. But I think it goes back earlier than 1898. I think it goes back to 1889, but I might be wrong.
Well, thank you.
And at that time, things did not go so well all the time, but when they were playing, everyone loved the music. Everyone that was playing loved to participate. Sometimes there was differences with band members and other band members and the band director. But most of them are no longer part of the band. But those were the good days. Well, as I remember. The band also played, the Minnesota State Band also played for a prom here on the fifth floor. And I was prom queen.
Oh!
I beat Mary Forsyth for prom queen.
Who was king?
Willard Munger. And it was done between session and when conference committees started in the middle of the third week of May.
We could maybe do this, get and this going again. Regularly.
It was a wonderful event. And the state band has played for other occasions here at the legislature from time to time over the many years before and after.
Mr. Chairman. Well,
thank you. Representative Kahn.
To beat that, we're going to send you with the state band to the Ukraine to bring peace there.
Yeah, and perhaps Representative Wills could be prom queen.
Princess,
I'm sorry. All right, well, thank you for the historical perspective on that, Representative Murphy. Representative Miller, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I actually do think this is legacy, and I'll support it. In fact, if I could find that you could be in Greater Minnesota more, I'd even fund it a little bit more. And I invite you to come to Princeburg, Minnesota at some time, perhaps on our July 3rd event that we have each year would be a great time for that. My question is actually for future edification, because when we were talking about all this budget, where the money came from before and stuff like that, some of the groups that are coming through are getting some money from Legacy and some from General Fund. And so if there's some time, not at the moment, but sometime in the future, if I could be clarified on how all that works with that money, that would be great. And my history lesson is perhaps it was Professor Harold Hill who started the first Minnesota state band. So that's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, actually. One is kind of a comment, but I'd like you to respond to it anyway. Given the fact that if you do get this money, and it's a pretty substantial increase, by the way, I don't know that there's precedence there or not, but You had mentioned that you may want to use some money to donate to another organization. I didn't hear very good because I was writing, but something you said other people contribute and you couldn't. I don't know if that fits into the category of legacy. Can you respond to that?
I can't speak to that. I don't really know. What I would like to be able to get tribute to is the commissioning of a work that is going on now that's being commissioned for the band. So it's sort of on the edge of all that. I'm not sure that it is legal or not in terms of the legacy funds, and we'd have to check that.
Okay.
I can't answer it well better than that.
Okay. Can I go again?
Yeah.
Mr. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question is along the same lines, and I have looked over many legislative auditor's reports on legacy, and there's dozens of violations that I would like to go back and correct. And so what I would like to ask you is when you put together your requests here or your proposed budget, have you looked at everything? And are you sure that everything that you're looking at would not violate any of the current laws?
Mr. Booty.
Thank you. I cannot speak to the laws in detail because I'm not sure that I know them. I can tell you that, for example, the travel costs are based on the per diem that is recommended by the state of Minnesota, both the lodging per diem and the food per diem. That the costs of the bus were verified with a bus company as current. That the other costs related to that were verified as current. On the instruments, by the way, I was not the one who said the state band needed a marimba, and if I could hang the AP person, I would be happy to do so. But if you look at the instrument things down there, prices are all over the map. We put an amount in the budget, and our intent there would be to purchase as inexpensively as reasonable. So part of the problem with the budget is it's very hard to be precise at this point. We've tried to be precise with the costs of touring. We've tried to put a number in there for the costs of instruments. And we've tried to be reasonable about it all. As to the increase, it's not really an increase in the conventional sense. It's a total expansion of new things to do. So it's things we can't do with the current budget, and hence the increase. If we're going to travel out state, we're going to have to pay for it. It is possible that we can find funds by asking the membership to pay. It's been done before. It can be done again. But it's much less easy to do. I think personally that I would like to see the membership buy in by supporting these tours. Those tours to Europe were entirely funded by the membership. They weren't funded by the state. And when you're traveling within the state, I think it's reasonable to think about dollars. I think it's also reasonable to say to the band members, we'd like to have you support this too in some way. So it's possible those numbers will go down. The other thing is, in that budget, the instrument cost is a one-shot thing. If I were to come back here in the next biennium, I suspect I would say to you, the number ought to be smaller, because you're not going to be buying $15,000 worth of instruments 2 years from now. It's highly unlikely that that would be the case. The touring costs aren't going to change. If anything, they're going to go up. But you know, I feel a little uncomfortable saying we probably ask for less money in the future. But maybe by then somebody else will be saying it. Does that help?
That does help. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. I just noticed gave us the sheet with the budget and also the upcoming concerts for the next year, and there does seem to be a pretty heavy presence in the metro area on this concert list. So I'm glad to see this. I think this would allow you to supplement your concert schedule into Greater Minnesota. I think that's a good thing. I remember the these invitations must have gone to every state representative or something, because I, a year or so or two ago, I hadn't heard of the Minnesota Band, and I got one of these in the mail. It was in my first term then, and I saw that they were, that you were playing at the Crystal Community Center, and I represent half of Crystal, and I see you're doing that again, so that's good to see. So I just went to see the band, was impressed, and then I remember going door to door this past fall and meeting a tuba player who lives in Robbinsdale in my district, and he sort of told me the situation with the rehearsal space. So that's another issue I'm hopeful that we can resolve this year, and certainly supportive of these requests.
The only thing in this that is out of the
Mr.
area
Booty.
Is the Faribault concert, and we can't use legacy funds, AMRAC funds, for that concert because it's out of the seven county metropolitan area. That's precisely the kind of thing we're trying to get away from, being caught by being a metropolitan group.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kahn. Would you like to make any final comments?
No, I would hope that we are able to fund this to some extent. We always know that we work around the numbers that we get, and I think the idea of having a Minnesota State Band, even if we're the only one in the country, is a really good idea.
Well, thank you, and we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
Chairman.
And I will hope, if my parking ran out at 2 o'clock, and the car I bought on Saturday has not been towed on Monday.
All right. Thank you.
We can't guarantee the non-ticket, but the towing is probably pretty slow.
A reminder that we are meeting at 12:45 tomorrow in room 10. We have a list of bills that we're going through. We won't be taking official action. They will be laid over for possible inclusion. I actually have a bill hearing in education finance for part of that time, so Representative Heinzman will be running part of the meeting tomorrow. Anything else? Well, then, this case is closed.